Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hello, and welcome to Words to Write By.
Hello, everybody. We just had a really awesome process group today about writer's block. I, for one, thought it was very informative.
Yes, we are right now reading a process group called Anne Lamont's Bird by Bird.
No, we are reading a process book.
I'm sorry. We are reading a process book right now by Anne Lamont called Bird by Bird. And as part of the reading, we decided we'd start our own process group on Zoom. It meets every 2 weeks and it's free. And if you go to our website, there's a link to get to it.
Yeah, just go to the website. Big old poster. Click on it.
And it's not just us. We have actually some really good people on there that just help so much when people have questions.
Yeah, we're not just up there like dispensing advice. Like it's a group effort.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's really fun. I look forward to it every other week.
And we also have a Patreon account. It's at patreon.com/wordstowritebypodcast, or you can find it from our website, wordstowritebypodcast.com. And on that site, we put up our bonus podcasts. Our goal when we're reading these books is not only just to read, but actually try out the advice. And we both try out the advice. And then we usually include one on the podcast and one on our Patreon bonus podcast. So you can learn a lot by listening to what people do, especially when we realize what we did wrong. And that's a good resource right there.
Yeah. It's very helpful for me. And I actually re-listened to the episodes. It's kind of like recording your workshop on your piece. And then you can go back and go, oh, yeah, that's what happened.
In our last episode, we discussed Anne Lamont's theories about writer's block, what it is, and how to solve it. Looking for some other takes on this, we reached out to a couple of authors.
Hi, I'm Patrick Dugan. I am a science fiction fantasy author. My newest book that just came out last month is called The Ashen Orb Bounty. It's on Amazon, or you can request it through bookstores.
How would you define writer's block?
So writer's block is an inability to tell a story or to get words on the page, which is usually highly frustrating and demoralizing.
Has it ever happened to you?
I think it's happened to everybody who's ever sat down to write. It doesn't happen to me a lot, but it does happen.
And what do you do when you have writer's block?
So I kind of look at writer's block maybe a little bit different. Usually I look at writer's block is either one of two things. Either my brain is not in the mode to tell stories, like if I'm under a lot of stress at work or family issues or kid issues or stuff like that. Sometimes you just can't get the creative juices flowing. And that is a sign for me to be like, time to walk away and handle the things I have to handle before I can get back to doing creative writing. The other time it happens is when I am trying to force a story to do something that it doesn't want to do. And I always hate it when it sounds mystical as far as writing, because it's a skill like any other. But, you know, a lot of times I find when I am, especially if I'm writing to a prompt or I have an idea that I want to hit and I'm doing everything in my power to get it to go that way, I find that a lot of times your brain just goes, no, that's not right. And then it balks because it's not how the story should go. And you know, it's not how the story should go, but you're trying to force it. At that point, I usually walk away from it and do something else. I'm a linear writer, so I don't normally write a scene in the same book. Though I know friends who do that, they'll jump to a chapter that they want to write and they'll write that. A lot of times I'll just work on something else. I'll go do social media, or I'll work on a short story, or I'll go work in the wood shop or something and give my mind time to digest. And usually what ends up happening is a day or two later, I go, oh, no, that's the solution to the problem. And then the words pop back up and I'm back to the races. It's very frustrating, but I also look at it as kind of a blessing in a way, because it can keep you from wasting a lot of your time writing stuff that's not going to end up working in the long run anyhow.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is John Gibson. I'm a fiction author of, well, going on five, soon to be five, novels. My genre is kind of mixed. It ranges everywhere from just, you know, drama to suspense. My two best works are my novel Soul Sprints. It's a drama about football and life in a small southern town. And then my book that I wrote after that was called Dividity.
What does the term writer's block mean to you?
Really, it just means that you're at a place as a writer where you can't really move forward. You're kind of stuck. And I think that's kind of generic sounding, but that's what it's always been for me. It's anything from just not having the words to, okay, you're in the middle of a story or at this point of a story, and you really don't know what the next point of the story is going to be. And you really can't move forward until, you know, something comes to you, kind of gets you over that hump.
And how have you gotten over that hump when you've encountered it?
You know, for me, no two writer's blocks are the same. I think one way to do it is simply walk away from it. I'm kind of a big believer in that. I know for myself as a writer, I would guess that this is probably the case for other writers as well. You get so into the creative process and you get your mind so sort of involved in what it is that you're doing. You don't even realize it, but your mind's kind of on a continuous loop that you can't break out of. But I think at that point, it's usually a good idea to kind of walk away and just go do something else. Go work out, go spend time with your family, go watch a movie. And you might even be amazed at what ideas come to you as you're interacting with those different types of elements.
Have you ever had a moment where you've walked away and suddenly the magic's all come back?
Yes, that's happened several times as I've been writing. You walk away, you do something else. And, you know, it's almost like giving your mind a breather, so to speak, giving your creativity that space to kind of breathe and reset. And that can be when the good ideas come to you, is when you have those moments of stepping away. But, you know, at other times, it's good just kind of push through, you know, and just write something, especially if you're in the early drafting stages. You know, you're always going to come back to that draft, that first draft especially, and do the editing and do the proofreading. So it doesn't really matter if you just sit there and write something at random, you know, to get those creative juices flowing again. So I would say anywhere in between those two kind of polar opposites, you know, walking away versus immersing yourself more are good things to do. And you have to be discerning about it. You have to figure out kind of where you are and do I need a break or do I need to kind of push through this? I mean, you know yourself better than anybody. You know, use your best judgment, but be wise about it.
Thank you. This was great. Okay. And with that, we are just about done with Bird by Bird. We're doing the final three chapters in the section called Publication and Other Reasons to Write.
This is the last full episode for Lamotte, because the next episode we will cover the last chapter, but segue into the new book.
Which we will tell you next episode in 2 weeks what it will be.
We will tell you next week.
Okay, so the first chapter is called Finding Your Voice. And this is a little bit different than your standard craft writing advice, which is finding your voice in order to improve your writing. Because in here, Anne Lamott is talking about the reason to write. One of the reasons to write is to find your voice. Is that what you got out of it, Renee?
I guess. These chapters are pretty empty now. There's so much left. What did you think she was saying in this chapter?
Well, I think it comes down to the whole memoir is cheaper than therapy approach, where there are things in your past that you felt a particular way on it and you were told that you were wrong and you kind of bottled up inside you that wrongness, and writing is a way to finally get it out and to finally say those important things in your own voice.
Right. But what does that have to do with voice? That is what I got confused in this chapter by.
And it doesn't have anything to do with craft. It is purely reasons to write are to find that voice of yours, which is hidden because people have told you not to say those things.
Oh, so, okay. So maybe I was reading this chapter wrong. I was not keeping in mind that we are in a new, like, this is part four, publication and other reasons to write. I don't remember that. Like, I'm not remembering the section title and making sure that I keep that in mind when I read the chapter, but I suppose I should have.
It sometimes does help.
I know, but I think it's weird. Anyway, I did not know what she meant by voice.
So it seems like there's two things. There's the thing that you want to say, the thing that you've always held back saying, and it's important to say that, but it's also saying it in your own voice. Because according to her, you can't say that thing and say Isabel Allende's voice or another famous writer's voice. It has to be your own. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yes, I do. But one of my thoughts is I'm just confused because she's toggling between content and voice, like what you're writing about and how you're sounding when you write it. But I can never tell which one she's talking about when she's talking about it.
Do you think the way that you write about stuff affects the importance of what you're writing about?
I think it's important that we establish what that means first before we can like move on to a conversation, especially since the title is Finding Your Voice. What are you finding? What are you looking for? Right. And writers have heard this. They've heard, you know, you need to develop your own voice.
They also talk that basically when you're reading other people's stuff, it's natural to take on their style. And it's perfectly okay for you to experiment using their style for writing exercises or even maybe like a short story or some piece that you just want to work through it. But that it's important in the long run to develop your own voice when writing.
Okay, so you are using style and voice synonymously.
Yeah. How would you separate them?
Well, there could be a lot of writers that use a similar style, but their voices are very different.
Okay, can you give me an example of style that two writers might use that have different voices?
Well, yeah. Okay, stylistically, Augustus Burroughs and David Sedaris are both snarky, self-deprecating memoirists.
Okay.
That is a style. Like, they got a style. It's conversational. It's, like, self-deprecating to the extreme.
Okay.
They're very wordy. Actually, David Sedaris, I would say he's more conversational because he writes in the essay form, so his form is different. Augustus Burroughs writes in the full-length memoir form, and so his stuff can get a little, like, heady and convoluted. Anyway, my point is that they are writing in a very similar style, but their voices are completely different. They sound different. They're utilizing similar tactics, but it's coming out as their own way of speaking or, well, their own way of sounding on the page.
So then voice is really linked to the person that you are. Like, we can all do the same job, but we do it them in different ways because we're different people. So by the very fact that you're an individual person, you will have your own voice when you're writing.
No, you won't. That's the problem. You have to practice. Bradbury talked about the same thing, that you will sound like a lot of other people. You will use the writing of other people and adopt their voices until you find your own. And she's pretty much saying the same thing. But voice is something you have to develop. You don't just start writing and ta-da, that's your voice. Like, you have to like work at it to figure out who do you sound like on the page, not who do you sound like when you speak, but who do you sound like on the page? What is the persona you're taking on? Does that make sense?
It's not persona because it's really you, right?
I don't believe it could be really you. No way, because this is writing. This is polished stuff. I don't think David Sedaris is as snarky as he is in his essays if you're just hanging out with him for coffee.
But you just said that the snarkiness was his style, not his voice.
Right. I just said his voice is something that has to be developed. And you don't just, you have to like figure out what it is while you're writing. Am I misunderstanding a question?
No, I think this is just a much bigger topic than this chapter in the book really allowed for.
That's what I'm saying. Okay.
So let's just say that we didn't get a lot out of this chapter. I'm going to read my favorite line from this chapter and we'll move on to the next chapter. My favorite line is, write as if your parents are dead.
I underline that one too.
Yeah.
I think this is an important topic.
Okay.
Maybe not in what she talked about. So pretty much what she says through the whole chapter is you're going to sound like other writers because you're reading those other writers and you want to emulate them because you love them. But at some point, you have to take a leap and do your own thing, I think.
But she's not saying you have to do it in order to become a better writer. She's saying that that's one of the benefits that writing gives you, is to make you take that leap.
Right. because you don't really know how you sound until you develop what's yours, who you are. It's an identity thing. The thing I tell my students is like, a lot of people, famous authors, you should be able to read it and go, oh, that sounds like maybe you. If you read some Faulkner, I'd probably be like, oh yeah, I bet that's Faulkner. And you'd be like, oh, that's Faulkner, you know, like Walter Cronkite had a very specific voice. You know, Johnny Depp has a very specific voice.
Johnny Depp's a writer?
No, I'm just saying their voice, literally like their auditory voice when they speak.
So I feel like there's a lot to talk about here, but I don't think this is the chapter to talk about it.
But it's the one called Finding Your Voice.
I know, but she doesn't really have anything in there. I mean, she does, but like none of the stuff that you're talking about, the difference between style and how to find your voice and what it means.
But wouldn't our listeners, don't they want to know how to develop a voice?
They're not going to learn it from this chapter.
They are certainly not going to learn it from this chapter. All right. I guess we shouldn't be dispelling our own advice like this. We're really focusing on the advice that we're given.
Well, also, I wasn't prepared to have a big discussion on style versus voice. I feel like we might end up being a little bit rambly.
That's true. Is there anything else you would like to say about this chapter?
No, not really.
Moving on.
Because the next one, giving, makes absolutely no sense to me. So please explain to me what giving's about.
Okay, there's a nice nugget in there. I think that explained it. I think giving is essentially attached to writing as a present.
So it's just the same as that chapter?
It's very similar. She says, two things put me in the spirit to give. One is that I have to come to think of almost everyone with whom I come into contact as a patient in the emergency room. So essentially she's saying, I'm writing for people. I think of my reader as somebody who needs a lot of help.
So she's writing to give help to people that read her book.
Yes. Or she comes at her stories with utmost sympathy.
Okay.
And trying to do as much as she can for people. I'm imagining what it would be like if, you know, my readers were emergency room patients.
They have a line here called, the giving is going to have to be its own reward. So what I kind of took out of this chapter is that learning how to be a giving writer will make you as a person a better person. And, you know, then she compares being a writer to raising children. And the one thing I will say is I do not recommend anybody have children because they think it will make you a better person. It'll just make you tired. That is not a reason to have kids, is to be a better person. I don't know if writing a book is to make yourself a better person or not. I mean, it could be. And maybe for like memoir or some sort of narrative nonfiction.
I would agree. I don't think writing a book makes you a better person at all. That's like saying, well, painting a painting makes you a better person. I mean, maybe.
The other line she has in here is from Ann Dillard, who has also written a craft book, which we'll cover at some point. She says that day by day, you have to give the work before you all the best stuff you have, not saving up for later projects. And I do believe that similar to something like meditation, like sitting down there and really giving what is inside you totally to something every day does kind of, you know, build up some better person vibes, just because the people I respect the most are the ones that give selflessly of themselves. But that's also a bit of a ego trip that, you know, your writing is giving out to the world and making it a better place.
I mean, you could do anything every day and say, because you have discipline, you're a better person. That's just an ego.
Well, not discipline, but that's sort of like throwing your all into a something.
Yeah, it could make you a better version of yourself. Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess that makes you a better person. So there was one other thing she said in here, which I actually really liked.
Okay.
She said one of the two things that puts her in the spirit to give, i.e. write, I suppose. The other is to think of the writers who have given a book to me and then to write a book back to them. This gift they have given us, which we pass on to those around us, was fashioned out of their lives. You wouldn't be a writer if reading had enriched your soul more than other pursuits. So essentially you write a book in response to a book you loved.
I see.
You know, like, oh, I'm writing this so that, you know, Margaret Atwood would really be proud. Or like, I'm so inspired by her work and I love it so much that I want to create something in response to her.
So all those Harry Potter fanfic writers out there, this is what it's all about, right?
Sure. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I get it. I get this one. I have this need to impress, like not on random people, but like I'm very much the teacher's pet. I want the teacher to really like my work. You know, like I'm writing it in my head. I'm thinking, oh, someone will go, hey, this was good. Somehow, you know, like some bigger writer might look at this and going, yeah, throw me a bone. Anyway, so if she's giving, that means that there's somebody on the other end of it. And if she's comparing giving to writing, then you're writing with somebody else on the other end. And this reminds me of Kurt Vonnegut. And he said he used to write to his dead sister.
Hmm.
It's like that letter that we did.
Yeah, last episode.
Do you have someone in mind when you're writing? Like, are you writing to somebody?
No, I'm not writing to somebody, but I am thinking about a reader reading, especially when I'm going sentence by sentence. Like, what are they picking up? What are they building in their head? But that's not what this is talking about at all, I don't think.
Are you sure? I think it is. Well, she says, so many of us can be soothed by writing. Think of how many times you've opened a book, read one line and said, yes, and I want to give people that feeling too of connection, communion.
Yeah, I don't necessarily...
Really? Okay.
Maybe it works for her, but again, I think that's a little bit of an ego thing.
Oh.
And then you kind of feel bad when like nobody appreciates it. I mean, there's nothing like writing something to make the world a better place or to impress people and have one person after another reject publishing it, which is the next chapter, but you know, still.
But this is the next chapter, yes. So there's nothing more cringeworthy than advice-giving poems written by undergraduate students. I guess that could be construed, what she just said, as an ego thing. But I don't know. What, you don't have an ideal reader in mind that they would take something away from this book besides just pure entertainment?
My ideal writer would go on to Goodreads and write a really good review of my book.
See, I would hope that somebody would read my book and be like, oh, God, yeah, my family's as toxic as hell, too. Thank God someone else has gone through that crap.
Okay, so I did think in my head one things I would like my book to be. And I would like my has-been boy band goes to a portal D&D world as a way of making all those gamers that, you know, are not appreciated and just feel like they're kind of alone and all that, realize that fangirls of boy bands experience very similar things, that they actually have a lot in common between the two groups. And that the fact that one would be derisive of the other one is completely wrong, because they have more in common than they do with other people out there, with the normals.
The normals. So you're kind of like uniting the jocks and the geeks.
I am. I'm trying to make a bridge between the D&D geeks and the gaming geeks and the boy band obsessed fangirls.
So you are giving this book is like a gift. It is being given to those readers, right?
There we go.
Okay.
Can we finish up with this chapter then?
Okay. Yes. This will be a very short episode if we don't talk about stuff.
So finally, we get to the publication chapter. Reasons to publish. Publication. And this chapter is something she's been teasing from the very beginning. Like in the beginning of the book, she says, and I will talk about publication at a later point. And now the very last, you know, main chapter of the book is about publication. And my question is, do you think this chapter was worth it?
It was necessary.
Do you think it was necessary for this book needed to have an actual chapter addressed publication? Or do you think it was necessary because people need to read a chapter like this about publication before they go and get themselves published?
I think it had to be in here because it is a writing craft book.
Okay.
And she's a published author, and it's expected that there will be a section on publication.
Because part of the reason why people pick up these books by people who are published, especially craft books written by writers that are famous for other types of writing besides writing craft books, is because we want to know the secret of how they got published.
Oh, you know what? You're right, because Bradbury did the same thing. See, I think it's a little weird. It doesn't have to be in there, but it's kind of expected. But Bradbury actually talked about how he got published.
He did.
But it's the process books.
And it was very exciting and fun, and a bunch of New York writers and New York publishers and all that.
He had the lunch.
Yes.
So that was a process book, but Gardner and Jack Bickham did not talk about those things.
No, they did not.
Interessant. Anyway, publication. What did you think of this chapter?
So the summation of what I think this chapter is about is there's a line there about bobsledding, and I'm adapting the line about bobsledding to be about what the chapter's about, because that's kind of what you put in there for. But basically, if you don't feel good enough about yourself before you publish, you won't feel good enough about yourself after you publish. So if you are relying on publishing a book to make you feel validated, then you are in for some disappointment, because this entire chapter is about how at various stages of publishing her first book and her later books, and at various stages when they sent her like the galleys and things like that, she would feel awesome for a very short period of time, and then she would drop back into the pits of despair and neuroses. Did you get anything else out of it?
That was mostly it. It went on for like 5 or 6 pages,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't really need to, but I think that concept is fair. I don't know. What do you?
Oh, I think it's completely fair, especially if you are going to be published. That means people are going to read your work and they're going to have opinions on it. And so if your opinion of yourself is based on having written a book, then you are going to hear people that don't like your book, and therefore you're going to feel like you're not worth anything.
Yeah.
Because no matter what you write, somebody out there will hate it. And unfortunately, the person that hates it might have the loudest voice.
Or everybody loves it, but you feel very empty. Like it didn't fix the problems you thought it was going to fix, whatever those problems might be.
Yeah. Although if everybody loved your book, that would probably fix a lot of problems.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think what she's saying is that even if things go really well overall, there's going to be places where you don't feel like people are paying enough attention to you.
Right.
Or places where you don't feel like you're being valued. And just because you printed a book, just because you published a book, isn't going to fix that, because there's always going to be dropouts.
It's not what it's cracked up to be, whatever it is.
I did like her example of the charity event that she was going to be a part of in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And how she was so excited to finally, after many, many years, be invited to be in this charity event. But because of when she was accepted, like her name wasn't attached to the original press announcement. And so they kept kind of dropping her name when they were making the announcements. And she was getting really kind of angry and frustrated because nobody knew that she was doing it. When she realized that, you know, that not only was it important that she do it, but that everyone know that she was doing it, and then points out that the whole thing was for charity.
Yeah.
Like, you keep pushing the goalposts of what it counts to say that you've arrived. So it's one thing to publish a book, but then you want to publish a book and you want good reviews. And then you want to publish a book and get reviews and have people that buy it. And then you want to have a published book, get good reviews, have people buy it, have the publishers give you more money for the next book. Like, there's all these things. And every time you succeed at one thing, you're going to say, oh, but I haven't done this yet. Or I failed at doing this next step.
Yeah. How do you think you will feel when you publish your book, Kim?
I think I will be really happy for a short period of time. And then I will feel kind of like then everybody's forgotten about it, because you get that initial hit, but it isn't sustained. Like, there are so many books out there, and there are so few people that read books, that chances are, you know, you're going to have that big hit of people reading your book right at the beginning, and then it's going to kind of be forgotten.
Right.
Or there'll be something else new that people are looking at.
I remember at that conference we went to, I don't remember, it was like last year, a year before, somebody had said something that was interesting. She said she had gotten published and they required her to do most of the promoting.
Mm-hmm.
They did a little bit, and they invested about a week of promotion when the book was finally launched out into bookstores and stuff. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. She got like a week, if that. And it was like, there's all this hype.
Yeah. And some people don't even get that.
People don't even get that. Yeah. Aren't you listening to a podcast talking about that?
Yeah. I listened to the Publisher Rodeo podcast, which does a really good job of basically picking through published authors' experiences at the point of being published and further on. And even for people that are successful, you know, by the standards that I have, they often can get frustrated. And one of the lines from it was that basically when people publish within a company, they'll often like a little publishing group. Like, these are all the writers that debuted in 2021. And they'll form like ties, and they, you know, they'll have a Discord server, and it's, they'll be a great support group. And for that year, when their books are coming out, you know, they'll all be there for each other. And this person was saying that, you know, they had that back in like, say in 2018. And then in 5 years later, 2023, they went back and looked at that list, and almost nobody on that list was still publishing. And these are people that had debut novels with a full traditional press, like not a small press, but like a tour or something like that.
Wow.
The lifetime of a published author in today's market is often 5 years for the majority of people to get published, because there's always a new batch of people coming up.
Wow. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we even doing this? What's wrong with us?
I think we have to go back to the earlier chapters in this section. The other way of looking at it is that once you've published a book, it's out there. And even if very few people read it, it's still out there. And if you don't publish it, it's never out there.
True. Well, I will say, with publication as the goal, that has made me a better writer, because I have revised so much.
I mean, the flip side about the whole fact that you are trying to get validation from publishing means that you are going to work really hard to get that validation. And after you publish, when you don't get that validation, you'll work really hard on the next book to get published and get that validation.
Yeah. Oh, she also said there's some people, when they finish a book, they start writing their next book. And you are that person, because that's what you started doing.
Yeah, and then I took a break.
Okay. So you had some momentum and then it stopped.
Well, I think that people that publish a book a year don't have time to take time off.
Oh, true. Anyway, so consensus is these three chapters are just okay. Publishing has some nice tidbits. Giving, depending on how you interpret what that's supposed to mean, I think it's kind of valuable to have someone on the other end, like in your head while you're writing. That may not necessarily be what she was thinking of when she wrote that, but that's where my brain went.
Mm-hmm.
And I think finding your voice is a really important topic. I don't think she necessarily nailed it, but she brought it up.
Yeah. And I think what's good about this too is most craft books focus on just getting a person to write, or getting a person to get to the middle of their book, like to keep coming back and working on it. But there's some value to, like, actually, well, what happens when you get done writing the book, or when you get close to done writing the book? What kind of stuff do you have to look forward then? So she addresses the fact that somebody reading this book is actually going to get to the point of finishing their novel or their book. So let's address what that's like as well.
Right.
She has a lot of faith in us as writers and readers.
She does. Although I would say she has a book on publication. This book's not a memoir, but her experience is very, you know, she doesn't talk about how she got published. Actually, no, she did. She talked about how she got published in the beginning of the book. Now she talks about the experience of getting published, which is totally out of most people's like experience, because she has an agent. I sent my book to my agent. I sent my book to my editor. I sent, you know, most of us don't have agents or editors. So I guess she's trying to explain like what's going to be like if our fantasies are fulfilled and we get the big publication and we have an agent and we have an editor.
You know, reading this book and seeing that people get disappointed during the publication process, for my pie in the sky dream of being published, it's good to know that when I get there, that I'm going to have these other things planned out to deal with other problems. So, you know, I'll be blessed to have these problems once I'm published. And this book prepares me for those wonderful problems that I'll have once I'm published.
Yeah.
It's like you say, so few people are published. And so few people then are published, like, you know, for many, many years in a row to get to the stage that Anne Lamont is. So maybe even this one that says the publishing isn't up all it's cracked up to be is also an aspirational chapter.
Did I ask, what do you think you'll get out of publication?
I think I mean, part of why I'm getting out of publication is the fact that I spent, you know, a bit more than a year telling people I was writing a novel, and now I can tell people that I've written a novel that's been published.
Right. Well, you've written a novel that's will get published eventually.
Right. So I've reached stage one. I can tell people, yes, I've written a novel. And then the next stage will be, yes, it's been published. And you can find it at this website.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you? What do you think you're going to get out of getting your memoir published?
I think the best thing that might come out of it is that I will get to go to like podunk towns that have these tiny libraries and maybe small bookstores. And I'll get to go drive or take planes all out of my pocket, right? No one will be paying for this, but I'll do readings of my chapters or something at a cafe or a bookstore. And I'll get to travel around these little towns and go to their thrift stores.
You know what else we can do? We can go to conventions if we have published books.
Yeah, we get to go to conventions. They probably get to go for free, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, so my husband, I tell him he doesn't have to read anything I write because he's just not into that stuff. And I don't expect him to be.
And you're not writing about him, so he doesn't have to worry about reading about himself in there.
Yes. And not only that, he's heard all these stories. He's just heard them out of my mouth. He doesn't have to read them too. And I said, you know, I'm going to invite you along to these towns. You know, if I get published and I get to do readings, right? You come with me and then you'll get to hear snippets. Then I'll buy you a beer and then we'll go to a thrift store.
And everyone will say, oh, you're Renee K. Nelson's husband. Wow.
And then I'll have a big stack of books trying to sell them and no one will buy them. Maybe like two people, but that's okay.
It's going to totally justify that van life he's got lined up, right?
Oh, they'll be in the van. Yeah. We'll probably have a van by then. And that's how we're getting from town to town.
Yeah.
Is a big van. Yeah. So I honestly, that to me is best case scenario.
Okay.
I really hope I get to do that. Like I get published and then I get to go around and do some readings and then I could put it on the shelf and walk away and go do something completely different, maybe. I don't know. Or write a novel. I want to write a novel, you know?
There you go. Is there a exercise for us to do from these sections here?
The closest thing I could figure out, it's the very beginning of a chapter. She lists some questions. Here we go. It's the second paragraph, first chapter. I often ask my students to scribble down in class the reason they want to write, why they are in my class, what is propelling them to do this sometimes excruciating, sometimes boring work. And over, they say, in effect, I will not be silenced again. We could do that. Not her class, but, you know, we could be like, what's the reason we want to write? Why did we read this craft book? And what is propelling us to do the sometimes excruciating, sometimes boring work? I don't know what purpose it would give us. Maybe it would give us like some kind of goal, but that is the closest I could come up with for a activity. That or trying to develop your voice from something you've been reading.
Oh, you know what? I think it'd be a fun one, actually. Let's go completely against the word. Let's find the most stylized writer we know and take two or three paragraphs of one of our books and rewrite it in that style.
That could be fun.
That could be fun.
So this is similar to an activity that I had old poetry group. It was a workshop, but it was like just a bunch of people. We just got together and hung out. One thing we would do, we had a game every time. Someone would say, okay, here's a poem by E.E. Cummings. And everyone would have to write an E.E. Cummings style poem and try to trick the group. And then we'd all have to vote who we thought E.E. Cummings was.
I see. So everyone would write an E.I. and you'd read them all. You'd pass them around, have everyone read one of them. And one of them would be the legit poem and the other ones would all be.
Yeah, one of them would be E.E. Cummings. And the rest of us would be us trying to trick everyone into thinking that we wrote an E.E. Cummings poem and you wouldn't pick E.E. Cummings. It was great. Actually, that activity was really good for me. It like stretches your literary muscles because you have to like play with the voices of others. Anyway, we could do that.
I think we should specifically though take something we've already written.
Okay.
And then adapt it to that other style.
Why do we have to find a really overly stylistic author to do that?
You don't have to find overly stylistic. You should find a writer who has a specific voice and then try writing that section of your own writing in that book voice.
Should we use the same author?
No, I think because, you know, you can only adapt your own writing to so many voices and still keep the content. So how about we each find somebody we think would be different enough from our own voice, but we can still tell that part of the story from their voice.
Okay.
Okay. And it doesn't sound like it's going to take too much time either, which is always a plus.
It might not take you much time. I'm going to geek out.
Okay. Get your geek on, Renee.
Get my geek out.
All right. We'll be back in a few minutes. And we're back. So I decided that I would take some writing in my own book, and I would then write it in another voice.
What's the voice? Did you... George R. R. Martin.
Awesome! Okay, that's cool. I like it. I'm a fan. I like our George R. R. Martin. He's a very clear writer.
He's a very clear writer. He doesn't have a lot of tics or anything like obvious. So I actually wanted to pick somebody that wasn't, you know, like easily recognizable.
Right. You know, he's got that prose that you just reach right through it and get to the idea. Like you don't even realize that you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
He's just so clear.
Yeah.
You don't. You know, he doesn't make things confusing. He just likes to talk about food. I hope you put some food in there.
No, I didn't. Okay. I the scene I had didn't have any food. So I'm going to start by reading what I had originally, and then I'm going to read what I changed it to.
Oh, okay.
Sufi Ravenous pressed her hand against the stones of the tower window and angled herself out. 30 feet below lay unforgiving cobblestone, but Sufi's gaze stretched further, beyond the fortress courtyard, past the battlements of its protective walls, and out to the ocean, gray in the early morning light. It was that flat expanse of water, even more than the impenetrable mountains to the south or the oppressive forests that crowded the northern bay, which reminded Sufi just how cut off from civilization of any place of importance the town of Bidlow was. But maybe not anymore. Sufi woke up before sunrise, her limbs prickled by 1,000 invisible needles. It was as if she'd managed to sleep funny in every part of her body. She knew this physical reaction meant a powerful spell beyond anything mortal magic users could harness had been cast. So that's why I did. And I was originally planning to write more, but I found this really hard.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. So this is like the opening scene of your book,
yeah,
right?
Yes, the opening scene of the first third person chapter and the introduction to the world. And I chose this one because George R. R. Martin has a lot of opening scenes from kids' perspectives in his first book. So I kind of used that. Anyway, this is how it came out. The sharp bite of the post-dawn air caught in Sufi's throat as she leaned out of the tower window. From this vantage, her eyes could barely discern the faint lightning in the still dark sky, but she could feel its magic hum through her skin. Sufi reached her arm out as far as she could to clasp the damp stone wall and pull her torso out past the ledge. 30 feet below her waited unforgiving cobblestone. Sufi had no thoughts for such an end. She gazed out beyond the fortress Bidlow's battlements and protective walls to an outcropping of rocks at the end of the causeway that marked the northern end of the town of Bidlow's harbor. Although she couldn't see the small temple that clung to the barren shore, she knew it was the source of the magic that had awoken her this early morning. And that revelation, more than the magic residue that still blanketed her skin and turned the back of her neck into hen flesh. Sufi had a natural affinity for detecting magic, a propensity unfortunately not evidenced by her other magical studies. And the forces this morning stung like 1,000 poking needles. It was too powerful, too indifferent to have been cast by a human. So those are my two paragraphs. What did you think?
I liked them. Both of them. Okay. I really did. Yeah. And I mean, I don't have any George R. R. Martin in front of me, but I imagined him in my head as you were reading it. So
you imagined the opening of a Game of Thrones episode, didn't you?
Of a chapter or of a book.
Yeah.
As I read the books. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. So wait, so you said this was difficult. Why was this difficult?
It was so hard.
Why?
Well, because if you listen to the original one, there's a lot of like heads here. So you've got, I got that description of the location that she's in, which ends with, which reminded Sufi just how cut off from civilization, from any place of importance, the town of Bidla was. Like, that's kind of opinionated. And I found that Martin's writings are not opinionated that way. I mean, he states world and he really shows you what's going on. A lot of bad things happen to people, but you don't ever have someone like languishing in sorrow. You know, they're just not as YA in their expression of emotions.
Right. The narrative distances further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Than it is in your book, even though they're both in third person.
Right. And I think that writing about Sufi, who's so warm and bubbly and outspoken and opinionated in that style, was difficult.
Mm.
Because I was really trying to match what was in the paragraphs. I wasn't trying to change anything. And then the reason why I thought this would be a good exercise was if given somebody's voice and able to write anything I want, I can totally write in that person's voice. It's not that hard. I mean, it's kind of a trick, but you know, you look at what their nuances are and you just go ahead and do it. But taking your own work that you've been very opinionated in what you want to put into it and trying to change to someone else's style, you really have to pull certain things out that are central. Like, the fact is, in my initial take on this chapter, it's the fact that Sufi is bored out of her mind in this town and she really wants to get out. And that's not a very George R. Martin sentiment.
Well, Sansa, she had delusions of teenagerhood. Remember the lemon tarts.
No, and he had some great kid characters, which is why I did that. But I found that I was just feeling, like, I used the example of waking up in the morning with the 1,000 invisible needles. It was as if she'd managed to sleep funny on every part of her body. And that's not a very George R. R. Martin thing to say.
No.
So I switched out to something else, did a look up and found out, you know, what other terms for goosebumps there was. And there was called hen flesh. So I used hen flesh.
He would totally do that. Yeah. He would use like an old term.
Mm-hmm. And I used a few of those in my book as well. But I just felt like, you're right, there was a distance.
Right.
Where I was used to be very close to this person. And there was also just a formality that felt very odd to write in.
I suspect having it just explained to me by you, I feel like maybe what Martin is doing then is, between the distance and the vocabulary, he is trying to create this world, and it's supposed to be a dark, dark world, mm-hmm. right? And that's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas yours is not so dark. There's a lot of happy feelings in your book. You know, it's not just this sad, dark place.
And also, his world is meant to be very medieval or whatever the time period. It's right. Very removed from our world. It does not share any things. And in my book, because this fantasy world has had people from other worlds visit, they've like pulled in a whole bunch of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of anachronisms that I use in my book because, well, they did actually, you know.
Right.
She did learn how to do a fist bump. There's a lot of fun stuff like that. So it just gives me a much looser voice to use. Yeah. A more modern voice.
Yeah. He's like posturing a little bit in his voice to, again, create the world through a more formal language, things like that. And it works to good effect for both pieces, you know. Mm-hmm. Even though you created distance, I liked them both. You could have gone either way, but I think changing the voice would have changed the plot even, because it would be weird to have that fun-loving stuff and fist bumps in that language.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I find really fascinating that the content and the voice are linked.
Mm-hmm. Or they should be linked. That's part of what makes it work. Like, somebody that has a really sarcastic voice would do a real hard time doing a melodrama. You just couldn't buy it.
Right. Right. You have to do it deadpan, or at least make it serious, even though it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can see that. So I'm just kind of curious, like, how did you approach this assignment?
Well, I took a look at the paragraph and I looked at the sentence and said, well, how would George R. Martin write the sentence?
So you just looked at the sentence and was like, this is what I think he would have done in my
Yeah, book. I looked at his writing. I noticed that there were very declarative sentences. He did have longer ones that were separated by commas, so it wasn't like only short sentences, but they were all very direct, a lot of vocabulary, and just that further lens. So I had to basically take something that was very close in, I had to pull back, while at the same time maintaining most of the content of what was there.
Right.
The issue was trying to keep the content in a different voice.
Yeah. What did you gain from this assignment? Do you think you gained anything?
You know, it was nice to see that I could write in a slightly more high fantasy style if I wanted, but I also saw how much of Sufi's character comes out in the voice that I use, even though it's a third person.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an interesting exercise, and it was kind of, it was neat.
Yeah. Do you think you, like, leveled up as a writer a little bit?
No, not for this one. I mean, sometimes I feel like I really do. Like, the other day when we wrote letters to each other, I thought that was a very useful thing to have written. This one, not so much.
Well, since I used to do this with some poet friends of mine, we used to do this. I thought it was really helpful for me.
Okay.
But it helped me locate what voice is. Maybe I can't articulate it, but it helps you see it.
And I think we'll talk about that with your writing sample, and that will be on our bonus podcast, which if you go to our site, you can find a link to our Patreon account where you can listen to our bonus podcasts. So I think that's about it. We've got one more week of Animal Lot, and then we'll send out a nice big announcement when we get that podcast posted, and it will have the information about our new book as well.
Yep, we are almost there.
Almost.
Almost there to a new book.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Otto. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
I wish I thought of that earlier and I would just be able to like bleh it out and then I know I'm trying to think.